Exodus chapter 14. We open the eyes of our imagination this morning to see nearly 2 million people standing on the brink of the sea. Now, you might wonder, why do they say 2 million people? Well, the text of Exodus says that there were 600,000 men besides children. Doesn't tell us women either. So if we think, say, of the average couple, there's 600,000 men, there would likely be 600,000 women. And that's immediately 1.2 million people if you add some kids in the mix. And then I was reading again and I realized that's right. You know, the Bible says that a mixed multitude left with them. So some of the Egyptians apparently, in some ways, half convinced and awed by the power that they saw, left with the Israelites. So we have an amazing group of people here, I think very likely 2 million, maybe more, standing on the brink of the sea. Some in awe, maybe to the point of tears at what they've just seen. Some with exclamations of joy, nearly jumping up and down. As I pondered the story, I thought about how the people, nearly 2 million of them, had crossed the Red Sea in haste. They were being pursued by the Egyptian army, and they didn't necessarily know what God was doing in detail. They knew that the sea had opened before them, the ground was dry, and they had a way across. And so they were coming across in haste, and maybe as they helped each other along and they scurried up the bank on the far side, they didn't look back a whole lot. They just kind of kept moving to get out of the way, to let the other people keep coming. They were running from Pharaoh and his army. The ones in the rear of the line coming last across the dry seabed had the most to fear from a human perspective. They were the closest to the army. If the army caught up, they would be trampled or pierced, or in whatever way, they would be the first to feel the wrath of Pharaoh. But the truth is that it is they, the ones who seemingly had the most to fear, who had front seats to the amazing work of God. Pharaoh and his army had descended into what was the Red Sea, now an open path. They descended in after them. They pursued, and suddenly our historical narrative relates something kind of humorous. It piques my interest a little bit. Someone might raise their hand and say, "Oh, Pastor, I know what God did. He brought the sea in and crushed the army." No. That's not what he did first. Now, he could have done any one of 1,000 things because he is the Almighty. And he could bring this battle as he wanted. He could simply say the word and the entire Egyptian army would stop breathing. They would die where they were and stop in their tracks. But that's not what he did. The text says that, I want you to see in chapter 14, beginning in verse 24. It came to pass that in the morning watch, the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels. So here they are, they're pursuing the Israelites, and they're, whether they're blinded in their rage, they're not thinking about the sea, or they're trying to put those doubts aside, whatever it is, here they go, they're pursuing the Egyptian army, and all of a sudden, this strange, almost universal calamity happens to the army, and all the chariot wheels are falling off. Now, was this a great sabotage? Well, it was by God. And they're driving along, and the wheels fall off the chariot, and suddenly the horse is just pulling this piece of metal through the ground there, and oh, that's not moving along very well. And what was their response? Verse 25. So that the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord," that's his name, "the I Am, I Exist, fights for them against the Egyptians." They begin to look around at each other, and they're scared, and they're probably scrambling. What should we do? Where do we go? Which direction? Do we keep pursuing? Do we run back? And as they begin to decide to run away, or as they're still deciding what to do, the Lord says to Moses on the shore, "Stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen." And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. there remained not so much as one of them. So finishing up our story from last week, we're reminded, as we see that Egyptian army in the bed of the Red Sea, and here come the closing of the walls. God had pushed back the Red Sea, and it literally was walls of water on either side as they walked through, young people. They walked through the middle of what would usually a sea on dry ground. But now God lets the walls go. I tried to do some research on how fast does water move when the dam breaks. There's the big long mathematical formula, and there's a lot of variables that they say. But certain people have charted it. When such and such a dam breaks, and the water begins to flow, and the pull of gravity, and the decline of the topography and things like that, they can structure how fast does the water flow and how long would this city down the river have to take cover or to flee. But just imagine, you know, we have somewhat of an idea of how water works. It's being held up by a God-given wall, if you will. It's a wall in itself. And all of a sudden, God says, the Israelites are through. Here's my judgment. And he pulls down the wall. And that water from both sides, however many feet tall it is, comes rushing in on them. And you know the power of water, the power of a lot of water. Have you ever seen footage of a tsunami coming onto shore? And it just is a wrecking ball, isn't it? When you have that kind of water coming with that speed and that force. And here the water comes to them. And we're not talking about ankle-high water. We're talking about something that obviously was a much more devastating, that when it hit them, absolutely threw them into the sea and just obliterated the army, and not one of them survived. Amazing. Amazing. And now the Israelites standing there, you know, I don't know that the ones who had already fled further, you know, to get the people out of the sea, if they were able to make it back in time to see what had happened. But the last people to get out of the sea and to turn around, but they know Moses is standing there lifting his hand, and some of them get to watch, and they get to see the water come in and crash against the Egyptian army, and now what's the response? They begin to sing. It says in chapter 15 and verse 1, "Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord. For he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation, my father's God, and I will exalt him." You know, isn't it appropriate? Then we recognize the power of our God and the nature of his deliverance. We would naturally lift up our hearts in song to him. We would sing to him. He would be the audience of our song, and we would exalt him in that song. I won't go through the entirety of their song. I'll take you to the last little bit of it in chapter 15 and verse 21. Miriam, Moses' sister, had part in this. It says, Miriam answered them, "Sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea." I thought about that. Verbiage, the horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea, as even a man on his horse pulling a chariot, or a man, you know, who thought he was in such command and with such power on a military vessel like a horse against the Israelites, and here comes a wall of water, and it just takes that horse and the rider and poof, this throws him into the rest of the sea, and they sing in praise to God. So they end on a pretty victorious, an exuberant note. They had been delivered in a magnificent way from the land of Egypt. And yet, they weren't very far away before they turned around and here came Pharaoh again. Now, never again. They would never turn around and see Pharaoh. They would never see an Egyptian army. That was taken care of once and for all. It was dealt with forever. They rejoiced. They were finally indeed free. And we see in chapter 15, verse 22, "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah." Now it tells us in pretty succinct form here, but you can kind of envision the story a little bit. You traveled now for 3 days. You have some provisions with you. Imagine you have some water stored up and some sort of a canteen. And as you go along and you're thinking about the deliverance of God, now it begins to get a little bit into the mundane. And you're thinking, you know, we're not seeing water, but I'm sure we'll get to it eventually. And finally, on the third day, there it is. Whoa, good thing. We can refill our water. And you imagine some of the first people, they run up there and it's going to be good. Oh, man, it's awful. Something wrong with that water. And they get up kind of disgusted, and they turn around. We can't drink that water. And you begin to hear the complaint like a ripple of water go through 2 million people. As, well, we can't drink the water. What are we supposed to do? Our kids are going to, we won't last so much water. What are we going to, how much further away? What was Moses trying to think about? And blah, 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 blah. And here it comes. And it begins to bubble through the people. Now, I thought about, you know, maybe there was some teenagers, you know, and the teenagers, we joke about, and somebody, I'm trying to look, oh yeah, he's in this room, and I don't want to embarrass him, but he said one time to me, Pastor Fox, it was disgusting, you should try it sometime. I love that. And so I'm thinking there's some teenagers that are going, oh man, this is nasty, gross, you ought to try it. And then the girl's like, oh no, I don't want to try it. And then the boys are like, oh, throw it in your bag. Oh no, 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 no. And so the teenagers are all running around, the adults are like, what are we going to do? They actually care about the things of life and how they're going to survive. And the teenagers are like, oh, no. Anyway, so they're disgruntled. And their first response here is to complain. It says they found a water. They called it Mara. So they kind of named the place. It's not that they said, oh, hey, here's that Mara, necessarily. They may have come and said, oh, gross. We're going to call this place Mara, bitter, because that's the water. And so look at verse 24, and the people murmured against Moses, saying, what should we drink? Now, they didn't ask, hey, Moses, what do you think we should do? Oh, no, Moses, it's bitter, but, you know, you talk to the Lord, and we'll wait to see what he says. It's, what are we going to drink? Right? And he cried unto the Lord. And it says in pretty short fashion here, the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. Now, you do have to wonder, why would God choose that there'd be bitter water and they'd have to throw a tree in it? Why would God choose that kind of symbolism? Now, we might read into it, and I think you can see a picture of the cross. When a tree is, you know, thrown into that bitterness, it becomes sweet. But I'm not going to elaborate on it much. But it's interesting. God has his ways and his methods, and he showed him a specific tree, and they threw it in, and he did what only God could do. And by throwing that tree in, the waters were made sweet or pleasant. Oh, all of a sudden now they could all get down there. Oh, they were drinking, and it tasted good, and it happened before their very eyes. Once again, God had done the miraculous. He'd not only done the 10 plagues, he had not only crushed the Egyptian army, now he was providing for their very needs and giving them some pleasant, sweet water in a place that they knew was bitter. It says the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. He put them to the test, if you will. Verse 26, and he said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians. For I am the Lord that healeth thee. So in a short time, 3 days, 3 days after the Red Sea, the people are murmuring. Does that tell you something through this accurate, true historical narrative about people? You know, if we admit we're saying, yeah, we're that way, it just doesn't take very long for us to, even on the brink of the miraculous, we murmur, we complain because we think about our fleshly appetite. What do we got to drink? And so they murmured, and God provided. The water was made sweet, and now he proves them. It says a statute, that the idea of a statute is a limit. I'm going to set a boundary for you, an ordinance, something that I'm going to set in place that if you'll listen, you'll obey. If you'll you know, govern your way by the way that I have for you, then you're not going to have the diseases that these Egyptians had. For I am the Lord that heareth thee. Jehovah Rapha, if you ever hear the word, or Jehovah Rophekah, That's the word used. The Lord that heals you. I'm the healing God. And if you'll obey me, I can keep all of these diseases away from you. In that context of having just had bitter water turn sweet, knowing that God can provide my needs, and once again, he is the miracle worker, then, yeah, he could keep these diseases away from me. But now the story moves on, and I want to keep rolling here into another episode of what went on, chapter 16. Verse 15:27. Remember, Pastor Aaron mentioned last week. I thought that was a neat description of the camp ministry, a place where you get away. And but we come to chapter 16, verse 1. They took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came unto the wilderness of Sin, or even Sin, maybe, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month of their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, where we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full, for ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." Now, of course, on the one hand, you go, you have totally lost perspective. I mean, we've only been on this trek for a matter of days, maybe weeks. And you're looking back to Egypt, and you portray it as, when we sat by the flesh pots. No, you weren't. You were under the whip. You were building cities for Pharaoh. You were under bondage. Do you remember that? Remember when he tried to kill your kids? Remember when he made your life miserable and hard? Oh, we sat by the flesh pots. But as I read it, I compared it with another scripture that I'm going to show you in a moment, it dawned on me that actually there might have been some truth to what they were saying in this phrase, "and when we did eat bread to the full." What were they saying? I think they were starting to say, "We're kind of hungry." And again, we came out of Egypt. I mean, we spoiled them, right? And we're pulling wagons, and we've got donkeys or horses, and we had provision. But we're a few days in and a few weeks in now, and we've been eating on our provisions. And there hasn't been a lot to restock, and we're getting a little low to where we say, you know, maybe for this meal, we shouldn't just pull out everything. Maybe we should kind of get down to the cheese and crackers, you know, and just kind of take it light for lunch. "Oh, but Mom, Dad, I would like more. I'm still hungry. What's for dessert? I haven't had enough." Well, that's all we got for now. Let's wait a little bit until supper time. And they begin to get kind of maybe scared, frustrated, angry. "When we were in Egypt, I remember eating the whole loaf of bread. I walked away going, 'Oh, man, am I full?'" Now, yeah, granted, I was a slave, and it was a difficult life. Of course, they're not remembering that now. "We sat by the flesh pots, and we ate bread to the full." But what was causing that? Was it something in them that was saying, "We don't have as much food now as we had then. We're a little hungry." The thirst, their thirst had been quenched now by the sweet water. Maybe they had rebuilt their supplies, but their food? Maybe the meals were getting smaller. And look at verse 4. "Then said the Lord unto Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you.'" Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. In that context of saying, we're starting to get hungry, our supplies are getting low, God says, if we were to take a poll and say, how do you think God's going to provide for this one? Right? Let's see. How did he wipe out the Egyptian army? Okay, he split the sea. Well, we wouldn't have necessarily guessed that one, but that was pretty amazing. We came up to some bitter water. How did he fix that one? Well, he threw a tree in it. That was kind of interesting. Yeah, I don't know if I'd guess that one either. Well, now we're hungry. How's God going to provide this one? Well, that wasn't the question. It was a murmur. It was a complaint. But if you're to ask, how is he going to do it? He'll make trees. He'll do like fruit trees. He'll look, boop, out of the ground, and they'll like be full of food. Maybe, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what the answers would be, right? But did anybody think that God would rain food out of heaven? That God would provide a breadish type substance or a cracker type substance on the ground every morning, and he would do it for 40 years. Every day, what they needed, he would rain bread from heaven. Now, they didn't know all the details yet, but he was beginning to tell them what he would do. But this morning, I want to take a cross-reference. Hold your place here and look over to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, toward the end of Moses' ministry there, and in the book of Deuteronomy, we read in chapter number 8 a remembrance of this time, a remembrance of what God had done over the time that Moses had led them there in those many years. And in Deuteronomy chapter number 8, in verse number 2, he says, "And thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness." Now, eventually, we'll come to the story that explains why it took 40 years to take what could have been a couple-month journey, okay? But that's not for now. But he says, as he's looking back, "God, how the way which the Lord thy God led thee 40 years in the wilderness to humble thee, to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no." And notice what he did, verse 3, "And he humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger and fed thee with manna." Oh, it's interesting. As I begin to overlay that, I say, you know what? Maybe they were getting hungry. Maybe their supplies were low. And their response was, "What are we going to eat? What are you bringing us out here for? To kill us and all of our kids in the wilderness? We should have..." And their default, as the human default is to grumble and to complain. But maybe there actually was a legitimate hunger, because Deuteronomy says, "He suffered thee to hunger and gave thee manna." You mean God planned the hunger? Right. God planned the hunger. It was by his design. Let me tell you, our perspective of God's provision is not balanced if we don't understand that God sometimes doesn't provide everything we think we want or what we think our bodies need. Now, the message, as I'm going to bring it to you here in the next few minutes, wouldn't necessarily be interesting. It wouldn't be new. I don't know that it would be as stark in almost any other country of the world or many countries of the world. This truth is going to come across as a strange thing because we're Americans, because we're so comfortable, because we're so blessed, that to think that God wouldn't provide comfort for us is kind of foreign. I want you to see 1 Corinthians chapter number 4. 1 Corinthians chapter number 4. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul is describing to the Corinthian people the state, the present state of his ministry. In 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 11, "Even unto this present hour, we both hunger and thirst, and are naked and are buffeted, and have no certain dwelling place, and labor, working with our own hands. Being reviled, we bless. Being persecuted, we suffer it. Being defamed, we entreat. We are made as the filth of the world and are the offscouring of all things unto this day." And he's not saying God has left us. Corinthians, get in your bunkers. God's no longer faithful. He was just stating it as a fact. That's where we're at. We're hungry. We're thirsty. We're reviled. We're persecuted. We're made like the filth of the world. 2 Corinthians chapter number 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And Paul is arguing here against other influences that had affected the Corinthians. I believe there in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 23, he says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool, I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft." And he begins to describe item after item and event after event and the things that he'd gone through. But I want you to see verse 27. Verse 27. "In weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. That described a part of what he had gone through and was going through in his ministry for the Lord. You consider believers in other countries and other ages. I don't think it was so foreign to them that life as a believer was going to be hard. When they owned Jesus Christ, they were going to be deprived. They were going to be afflicted. They were going to be pushed out. They were going to suffer loneliness. They very well might be hungry. It wasn't a foreign thing to them. Have you ever read the Fox's Book of Martyrs? And read about person after person who didn't live in a nice, comfortable house, refrigerator always full, 9-to-5 job, comfortable furniture, a nice temperature in the house, calm political environment, whatever. No, in fact, they were taken to the stake. Or they were tied up to a thing that we call the rack, where they begin to stretch them, pull them until their limbs are pulled out of joint. And it's not only in history, in that history, it's even in inspired history in Hebrews chapter number 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, I'm awed by verses 32 and following, Hebrews chapter 11, when the writer of Hebrews says, "What shall I more say?" It's talking about people whose lives were governed by their faith. "For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah and David also and Samuel and of the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions." Now that's where we want to be. "Quenched the violence of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens." Yeah, now that's the life of faith that I'm talking about. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonments. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder, like put in a log and sawn through. Yes, were tempted. Were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. Wait, I thought this was a faith chapter. I thought God is good, and I thought that he would always provide for my needs. Yes, all of that is true. And yet maybe we have a skewed vision if we think that always means we're comfortable. And if it thinks we'll never miss a meal, or that we'll never be tortured, or that we'll never be imprisoned, or that we'll never wander around tormented. And yet his perspective, God's perspective, verse 38, "of whom the world was not worthy." They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. "And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." God is looking at something bigger than our next meal. Sometimes he permits, he even leads us into hunger, wanderings, poverty, pain, and enables us in it to show a stark contrast to this wicked, self-indulgent, rebellious world. And maybe by our very attitude and perseverance and our death, we're a light to this dark world and he is glorified. It went so far beyond our next meal to the design of God to magnify himself to the world. So we go back to our text and they say, "We remember when we ate bread to the full." They probably do. They probably remember when they had more food than they had right now. Why? Why did God lead him into that? Now, I'm going to give a personal assumption that it set the stage for this next lesson. Now, the text actually tells us another lesson, which is even deeper and neater still. But do you think God sometimes provides hunger to set up the contrast that when he gives it to us, we're thankful for it? Have you been thankful for the meals that you eat? Been thankful? Have you thanked God recently that you constantly have stuff in the refrigerator, that you have money to go to a massive grocery store that got aisles and aisles and aisles of food, and you pick out the thing that you like the most and that tastes the best and that you prefer, and then you go home and you fix it like you want, and you eat as much as you want, and you store the leftovers and have it again? Have you thought to thank the Lord for it? If he were to start taking it away, if you kind of had to wheedle it down to two meals a day, maybe one meal a day, and then maybe you kind of had to buy some bulk rice and some potatoes so that you could sort of, you know, just eat the starches, you know, and try to fill the belly, I bet if things turned around again and you experienced a month down the road what you experience now, you would think you're in paradise. It's amazing once I have a full refrigerator back and can choose my food and have all that. So yeah, God can set the stage. And sometimes by taking and pulling it away, we realize what he's given to us, and then he can give it back. But there's more than that, actually. God sometimes provides hunger because he knows we need it more than food. I thought God was going to provide for my needs. He is. That's exactly what he's doing. And you don't need food right now. You need more to know that he provides for you. You need more to focus on him. And if this constant food gets in your way, then God can take that away because he is good and because he is faithful. We've been studying on Wednesday nights through Philippians. And in Philippians chapter 4, we just recently looked at Paul saying, I have learned how to be full. And I've learned how to be hungry. It wasn't strange in Paul's mind. God didn't somehow become less God when Paul was hungry. He said, these are states I have to deal with. Sometimes I have a lot, and sometimes I have a little. And either way, it's always enough. And it's always fine for me to keep working for God. But yes, now the bread of heaven would stand in contrast to their hunger. They would be alert to God's provision for them. But God taught them a deeper lesson still. Let me find it again in our text in Exodus chapter number 16 and verse number 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and bring in twice as much as they gather daily. Why? Because he was wanting them to, you know, rest the seventh day. And so they would gather twice as much on that sixth day. And Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, at even ye shall know that the Lord hath brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning, then ye shall see the glory of the Lord, for that he heareth your murmurings against the Lord. And what are we that ye murmur against us? And Moses said, this shall be when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord heareth your murmurings, which ye murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. And he provided then that, what they called manna. Let's see, verse number 11. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak unto them, saying, at even ye shall eat flesh. Flesh? Well, we don't have any flesh. It's all gone. Oh, no, you know, you're going to eat it. And in the morning ye shall be filled with bread. And ye shall know that I am the I am your God. And it came to pass that at even, the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning the dew lay round about the host. And when the dew that lay was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness, there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoarfrost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat. So believe it or not, what are we going to eat? How's God going to provide for us? And no joke, a bunch of birds went and just fell on the ground. You want meat? Oh, God can give you meat. And in the morning, so well, they get probably get out there, they start plucking those things and getting them ready. And in the morning, the dew comes, and when the dew dries up, there's just something on the ground now. They see it's different, this little small thing. He said, that's the bread. That's what God's providing for you. Now you go collect that stuff, and it describes it later, and it says it's like the taste of a wafer made with honey. It tastes kind of good. It's like God's just providing that bread for us just out of nowhere. And he said, I'm trying to find the spot. I didn't write it down, but let me just tell you. He says, I've done this to show you. To show you what? That God can provide food. No, that actually wasn't the lesson. I've done this that they might know that man doth not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. You know, I take away that food and you start to get a little hungry. And what does it do? It rattles you to an alertness to say, you know what? If I'm going to survive out here, God's got to provide. And you know, the truth is, here's the extension. God has to provide everything. You know, the only way that I exist, the only way that I live is by God's provision. Whether he delivers me from an afflicting nation, whether he crushes an army, whether he makes water sweet, whether he provides birds that fall out of the sky, whether he makes bread just appear from heaven. The only way I'm going to make it is God. God's going to have to provide for me. It's not me constantly looking to bread. God, where's bread? I need bread. I need bread. No, I don't need bread. I need God. I need the provider of the bread. And I need so much more than the bread that he provides. Do you see that? God can provide a hunger because we need it. And God can put us in pain, and it's okay. It's a part of the design. That when we do without, God didn't suddenly become unfaithful. That's what he wants. And that's what we need. And if it awakens us to the need that we need God more than anything, and whatever he provides and however he provides is what we need, we don't look to the earthly thing and say, oh God, you're not God because you're not providing the earthly thing that I want. No, it's God that we need and whatever he provides. He provides sweet water and heavenly bread, no doubt about it. I wonder how much more egregious is it to complain in America? I mean, look at us. We're just swimming in it. We've got so much. You know, we drive in our nice car. We get out and we start up our car. We drive down a smooth road. We go to a job where they give us money to do this stuff. We go to stores. We go to events. We watch our TV. We do all these things in comfort. We set our thermostat where we want it. All this stuff. Are we really pressured? Are we really afflicted? Are we really hungry at all? We look at other countries and the culture that they live in. Remember I told you Alicia Stensis? She gave a Christmas gift to some of her teachers. It was a can so that they had something, they had a new can to walk down to the water hole so that they could carry their water for the day back home. And I've seen it. I was there. You see somebody on a bicycle wheeling their water back up to their house. I've seen the guy out by the roadside holding his string of fish. That's his income for the day. He got up early in the morning to go fishing so that he could sell this fish so that he had a few bucks or something. Right? We look at that and go, how do you people survive? How do you Christians survive in an environment like that? How do you have joy and feel that God is good and providing? I wonder if they have a clearer picture of God than we do sometimes because we're almost clouded by the amount of provision that we have. And then we begin to think that if I have to turn the thermostat down, or if grocery prices get a little bit higher, or my car breaks down, that, God, where are you? Are you faithful anymore? No, we need God. And whatever he provides and however he provides it. Next time something happens and you feel hungry, you're in pain, you're lonely, quell the initial desire to go, "Well, what?" Stop and say, "God, what do you want? Lord, you're the Almighty. You're the God who heals. And you're the provider. What do you want to do about this? I might think I know how I would want it to happen, but God, what do you want? Do you want this car fixed? If so, would you give me wisdom to know how to do it? God, we don't seem to have money for groceries, at least not the groceries that we feel like would be enough for the family, but it's okay. I would ask you for our daily bread, and if you'd provide it, I'll praise you. Show me what to do, but just guide the way. God, I need you. I need your direction. I need your provision. I need you more than I need any food or car or comfort. I need you." And if our hearts are drawn to that place, the hunger is serving its purpose. The pain is drawing our attention to the God who loves us, to the God who deserves all glory. Do you approach God in humility and trust, or with complaint and accusation? We're going to deal with it down the road, but he's going to come to a place where he says, 10 times you've proved me. What? You mean the people put God to the test? They kind of said, "All right, God, let's see if you've got the right answers," basically. They tested God. How arrogant. But they did. Is that what we're doing? "Well, God, you're not meeting the bar here. You're not answering the question right." Or are we submitting and we're being the student and submitting to the test? Can you trust God in the lean times and in the pain and know that this may be a part of his perfect work? Heard the story from another preacher recently who, when he was young, when he was 8 years old, his mom contracted polio. Said he came downstairs and she was curled up and said, "Go get your dad, I'm really sick." And so they came and got her, and she never walked again. She went into the hospital, was in the hospital for 2 years. About 1 year in, they had the opportunity to go visit her, and it was so contagious. They really, really tried to quarantine people off, and so they could see her through like the glass somehow. And they wheeled her to the door of her room, and she said to the nurse, "Could you turn my head so I could see my children?" And her son stood there, and he said, in his mind, he thought, "God, couldn't you have left her neck?" And the nurse came to him and said, "Your mom said, stop thinking that." I was like, "Man, how does she know that?" Then his mom sent another message and said something like, "Your mom's praising God for what he's doing. He's doing all things well." Can we believe that? Is our belief that God's way is perfect and that he does all things well, is it conditioned on our comfort? If so, we're wrong. We've got to look to God. Why do our children need this story? Can you see? Son, daughter, life may get rough, and I'm not gonna tell you that you'll always be comfortable. And I'm not going to tell you that you're not going to see some really tough things in life. And I'm not going to tell you that there couldn't be a day when we'd be ripped apart. But I'm going to tell you that God is always worthy of praise. He always does things well. He is always the perfect God. And in those times of pain and loneliness and hunger, oh, don't get mad at him. Cry out to him and say, "God, what do you want next? What do you want from me?" Oh, young people, look to him. Know that God is perfect.